If you're rocking to get up and it's not a rocking chair, it's time for the Joint Relief Institute. Fast relief, covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
WGN. Hello there. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. A little bit later in the program, we're going to be checking in with regular contributor of this show, Greg Trotter from Chicago Tribune. We're going to be talking about a brewery. We've been talking about a lot of booze on this show lately, Griffin, I feel like. Maybe. A lot of beer in particular.
Yeah, I don't know.
Hey, whatever.
It's the end of summer.
It's the end of summer. Group mind, whatever. We're all thinking about it, I suppose. Another thing we have talked about an awful lot on this show is we've talked a lot about Elon Musk and his leadership. We've talked about a lot of Silicon Valley leaders and how many of them are kind of these, I don't know. I don't want to say iconic, although people say iconic, but I think later, you know what I mean? They like want to be iconic.
Yeah. Well, I think we're living in a time where, you know, they were like the leaders of the new industry that we all didn't know what to expect from. And now we're kind of seeing what we couldn't have anticipated. Like, we didn't know what kind of historical figures they might turn out to be. And at
That's
least
right.
in the moment, we're seeing a lot of them not live up to the ideals or expectations that we had for them, say, 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think in particular, as we've talked about with some of them, just because you have a brilliant idea and know how to execute it doesn't necessarily make you a good leader or manager or business person, right? And I think that's where when companies become especially large and successful, your idea worked, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're great at being a CEO or something like that.
Or you were great at it for that initial stage of, you know, company building, but then there's a whole other thing that, you know, then sustaining is kind of a different skill set.
Is a whole other thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in the case of Elon Musk in particular, you know, I won't say we, because I'm not going to lump you in with this, but I know I have certainly kind of scoffed and rolled my eyes a little about his like glorifying his obsessive busyness. And I admire that he's willing to go, I don't care if it's impossible, I'm going to try. You know, I think, okay, that's fair enough, even though if you could maybe not mess with our city infrastructure here in Chicago, that'd be great. But, you know, like in particular him launching SpaceX, I was like, well, that seems like a very wealthy person problem and ambition that you got going there.
Yeah, commercial space flight.
Yeah. Like, but okay, sure, you do you.
I have a very similar knee-jerk reaction to him as a person. He did take electric cars and make it into something much more than it was before he took it on. You know, like Tesla, as a manufacturer of electric cars, is a real force or has been. And that's changed, I think, the public perception of the future of electric cars.
Yes.
Like completely.
Right, because like the Tesla is a good looking car. People would want to drive either way.
Yes, yeah.
And so suddenly it went from kind of this boxy thing that I might have to plug in to like, oh, that's kind of a sexy car. I would drive that, you know?
So that's a huge deal, but everything else. So you have to give him that, I think.
I guess.
Some people might disagree with that even, but.
Yeah, even that I'm kind of on the fence at this point. Because what he's like, he's at this point now where, you know, it seems like he's in the self-destruct mode, right? So he had this interview and it was broadcast and it was, you know, he's crying in the interview talking about the stress of this and all this stuff. But he's kind of gone back and forth about his state of being a couple of times. And so it's brought up a question that's coming up with a lot of these tech companies, as we alluded to at the top of this whole discussion about, you know, are you, just because you started the company, does that mean you need to keep running it? And are you the best person? You know, I know we talked just week before last about this very conversation happening at Facebook. Like, is Zuckerberg the right person to keep running it at this stage that it's in? And I think we're at this point now with Elon Musk.
Especially comes after he had a proposal to take the company private.
Right.
Of which he made
a huge deal.
A very public statement about taking the company private without seemingly any consulting with anyone.
It was a very Trumpian move to be like, here's what I'm doing. And it just kind of like this announcement that seemed to take even his own leadership team quite by surprise.
Right. And so now the company is facing SEC investigations and just the coming months are going to be, I think, a lot of red tape for them. And that's really amplified calls for him to maybe not have such a central role in the company.
Yeah. I mean, you know,
And I think people have had this feeling about him as like celebrity CEO.
That's right.
Kind of an erratic and tenuous position for a leader of a company to have. But we haven't seen concrete, whatever the word I'm looking for, consequences to that.
And yet. Now we are.
And now it's starting to seem like this is actually going to be more of just, as opposed to just a PR problem, like there are going to be real consequences for the way that he's conducted his business in public.
I mean, I would add to that that just a few years ago, he was really unsympathetically glorifying like his commitment to busyness and really like, if you don't keep my kind of hours, you're not really an entrepreneur. And if you're not like, you know, he was really priding himself on his, how out of touch he was with being a human being with needs like rest and rejuvenation and things like that, which I think got a lot of people scoffing. I think it got some people in the tech sector kind of like, yeah, that's the spirit in it. But I think a lot of people were just going, dude.
Well, that is, and that's also kind of a troubling trend just in the way that we talk about work. Is,
absolutely.
Glorifying that kind of overwork.
Yeah. We've talked about that many times, kind of the glorification of busy, and it won't be the last time. That's for sure. There's plenty more where that came from. But we are going to take a little break, and we come back, we are going to be talking with Greg Trotter from the Tribune about a brewery locally and an interesting story happening there. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us. A little bit later on the other side of news, we're going to be taking a look at Burning Man, that festival that's going on right now. It's out in the desert, lots of body paint, lots of glitter, whatnot. But we're going to take a look at how it has evolved over time, because it has been around for 3 decades. It still seems kind of new, but no, not so much. So we're going to take a look at some technology factors in particular there. But we are joined right now by regular contributor to this program, Greg Trotter, reporter covering the food and beverage industry at Chicago Tribune. Greg, welcome back to the show. Always a pleasure to have you.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Well, certainly. Thanks for taking time out of your Saturday to talk with us. And so there are, you know, always such interesting and compelling and sometimes really heart-wrenching stories attached to the small business owners. And, you know, I think sometimes we talk about business in terms of just the business and just what the customers see, but there's always human beings behind it and always very, very human components that make up those businesses. And indeed, life happens, good and bad. And there's a story you wrote about recently about a Glenview brewery that is really just like uplifting, but also heartbreaking and all the things. Tell us about it, if you will.
Yeah, thank you. So the brewery is called Makushla Brewing. It's in Glenview, and it's almost exactly 1 year old. It opened, it had a soft opening on August 22nd of last year, and then had its official opening a couple weeks later. But this was sort of the passion and dream of Mike Welch, who was the founder. Mike was a longtime bond trader at the Chicago Board of Trade, and decided at age 39 that he really wanted to pursue this dream of his and open a craft brewery. He had been home brewing at home and really liked the idea of bringing people together with a brewery. He's big into music, so he wanted to eventually have a music venue as part of it. And so this was a big kind of passion project for him and for his wife, Megan. And then so they opened it about a year ago, and then in April, on April 17th, Mike died of a heart attack in his sleep at age 44. And so the story that I wrote is really about how Megan and the rest of Mike's family and friends have really sort of rallied to help keep the brewery going in the wake of this immense loss.
Right. I mean, the story opens, and for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet it out after the program, but the story opens kind of this little scene of her carrying on, doing this stuff, running the brewery, lifting heavy stuff, but, you know, also kind of fighting tears and saying, like, this isn't my passion, it was his, so I have no choice but to keep going here.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, she and, you know, the family, I mean, they're still very much in their grief, of course, you know. And so this is not an easy thing at all. I think it's very hard probably just to show up each day, but it's also sort of bittersweet, you know. I mean, she enjoyed doing it, running the brewery with Mike. And so, you know, showing up each day, I think, you know, sort of being so reminded of him in this place, I think it's difficult. And but on the other hand, I think, you know, that she likes it too, and that they're and so she's had to step up in all of these very difficult ways. I mean, just logistically, in terms of running the business, you know, they had to, it took weeks for them just to be able to unlock his phone, and then all of the accounts linked to the business, and, you know, figuring out which forms to file and how does he keep his books. Like, that, those were all things that Mike used to do, and now Megan has had to sort of unlock all of that. So there's the practical side of how it's been very difficult. And, you know, she credits Mike's brother and cousins for helping her through all of that. And then there's obviously the emotional aspect of it as well.
Sure, of just grieving your spouse, while, you know, much less,
yes,
you know, trying to run a business and do all of that. Yeah, that was an interesting detail about the son guessing the password to the phone, and that enabled the business to keep running. But there was a couple of other details that, I mean, I just thought were just, you know, goosebumps inducing and just kind of eerie about, like, the name of the brewery and about how that's about... and the logo with the heart, and how that word, you know, the name of it means my pulse, named for his children. And then it was a heart, you know, a heart attack was the cause of death. And there's just, I mean, that's so spooky now, here in hindsight.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's in one of his cousin Marcella even sort of pointed all of that out to me. I'd been sort of thinking about some of that symbolism anyway. But just, you know, the logo on each glass is a heart with the arteries, and Makushla, yeah, my pulse is transliteration of a Gaelic phrase that means my pulse, or, you know, my lifeblood. And also he was known as a very kind man. And so he had a big heart, and his heart attack was caused by having an enlarged heart, a condition that his family didn't know he had. So, yeah, I mean,
there's a lot there.
Yeah, there is a lot there.
And so, okay, so the brewery, they're carrying on, they're doing their thing. What is next for them, and what are they, you know, what do they need to overcome to keep going with all this?
Well, I mean, I think it's kind of one day at a time. You know, they want to grow the business, but I think they're going to stay focused on growing the business right where they're at now. They're across the parking lot from Hackney's on Lake. So Mike was a fourth generation member of the family that runs Hackney's, which is an institution in Glenview. Everybody in the North Shore would know about Hackney's, longtime family restaurant there. And so, you know, the beers are named for, you know, members of his family, his grandparents. And so there are family ties there. And so they're going to, you know, from what I understand, they're going to focus on growing there and growing slowly and taking it one day at a time and just building the community. It's not an easy thing to open a new craft brewery. The market's very saturated. There's tap rooms all over the place now, so it's hard to stand out anyway. But it seemed very much to me like the family is united and wanting to keep this brewery going and have it be successful to honor Mike, and to honor his dream. And so that's what they're set out to do.
Yeah. What a really, as you said, very bittersweet story, of this family, you know, having to persevere and even choosing to stay open, like, in the immediate days after, its founder's death. So again, for those of you who follow me on social media, I'm going to be sure and share the story so you can read it for yourself. It is a really, really beautiful one, despite, you know, all this tragedy, this family pulling together to make this business work. Well, Greg Trotter, reporter covering food and beverage at Chicago Tribune, thanks so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you, Amy. And I just wanted to also point out that the story will be in tomorrow's, in the Sunday Chicago Tribune as well, if people want to read it that way.
The old-fashioned way, with a paper and everything.
That's right.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Greg. Have a good weekend.
All right. Thank you. See you.
Bye. All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us. Well, here on the 18th floor overlooking all the beautiful city and the beautiful lake behind us, even though it's kind of a dreary day. Miles and miles away, what's happening in the desert is Burning Man. That's been happening for almost 3 decades now. I can't believe it. It still in my mind feels kind of like a new thing. And, you know, when we think of Burning Man, a lot of times people go, oh, the body glitter and the, you know, the partying and all of that kind of thing. But at its core, it's really, it was developed to be this kind of anti-consumer, get back to just being human beings sort of thing. So joining us now is Laura M. Holson, who wrote about Burning Man and who is here to talk about how it has changed over time, because having been around for so long and technology has moved in so many interesting ways, indeed so has the festival. Laura, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, happy Saturday. What are you both doing working? There's something wrong on that with that.
Right, there you go. So tell us about how Burning Man has changed over these 3 decades, if you would.
You know, Burning Man started in San Francisco. There was a man by the name of his name just went out of my head, Harvey. And he decided that he wanted to burn a 8-foot-tall man on the beach in Baker Beach in San Francisco. And the lore around it is that he did it because of a romantic relationship gone awry. But he invited his friends to burn this man, and all these people showed up. And he started doing it every single year. And the fire marshals showed up, and they said, you can't burn, you know, your man anymore here. So they moved to Black Rock Desert in Nevada. And since then, it's turned into this kind of huge celebration, if you will, of art, of technology, of making things, of self-sufficiency, that 70,000 people attend now every year, every day, around Labor Day usually.
And there's always interesting art projects that come out of it every year. You know, there'll be a photo exhibit or just asking random people to answer a simple question or something like that. So there is a lot of, still so much going on there. And so although it started so humbly, and there's a couple of other ones that are kind of like there's a sort of similar one in Santa Fe, New Mexico, that where you're supposed to put like divorce papers or a mortgage or whatever into this giant man and then burn it, and like as a way of ridding yourself of things. So I totally get that idea of, you know, him wanting to move from a relationship into a new kind of mental space there. Is that sense there still of that there's a commemoration with the actual Burning Man part of it?
I mean, the founder, you know, Larry Harvey, I don't think it's about relationships anymore. It's really about radical self-expressionism. And Larry very much wanted people to express themselves in their most full way. And whether that's, building, tall, they have these colossal art structures, right? I mean, it's not all about romance. It's about innovation. Mm-hmm. They have, one guy was telling me about a man that he saw on a bicycle that had like a teddy bear in a bicycle. And then, you know, attached to the teddy bear was on a bicycle was another teddy bear on a bicycle. And so there was like 10 down, and he saw these like 10 teddy bears in a row, you know, kind of this guy riding across the desert with his teddy bears. So it's really about people expressing themselves fully. I think that's really the theme.
Yeah. So let's talk about a year or two ago, there was some demographic information released and a bit of a response to that. Tell us about that part, if you would.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's interesting is people have, when they talk about Burning Man, they see it as primarily a place of wealthy white, Caucasian people attend. And on some level, if you look at the census, it bears it out. The income of people is super high. You know, a lot of them come from Silicon Valley, so they're technologists, you know, who make a lot of money. Not as many Hispanics or African Americans or Native American Indians who actually go. And one of the reasons why, I mean, at one point they were trying to study, you know, why this happened. And, the thinking was is that people just didn't feel welcome if you were a minority. I mean, because it's perceived as this wealthy, you know, Caucasian, you know, white celebration, people didn't really want to show up or didn't really know that they could show up. Mm-hmm. And I think that's changing a bit. I mean, there's been some, you know, discussion recently about trying to make it, you know, more inclusive.
And here in a moment that, you know, we're still in many phases of the Me Too movement, and that's ongoing, and a lot of critical conversations are happening out in a public space that we've long had behind closed doors. Here's Burning Man, that's long been very, you know, very sex positive, very body positive, and all about openness. Where is any of that, you know, showing up or changing anything? Just these conversations that we've been having, are they intersecting with this at all?
Well, I think that there's more of a heightened consciousness of sexual assault, you know, sexual harassment, culturally. Like, that's just across the culture of the United States. So as you can imagine, there's a different kind of understanding of that or a different discussion about that happening at Burning Man as well. But they have always, you know, I think going back to 2012 and probably prior to that, have warn people or said to people, you know, sexual harassment, sexual assault is not allowed. It's not welcome. If you see something, say something. If it's something happening to you or you see something happening to someone else, you know, say something. So, you know, they have, you know, been discussing it for much longer, I think, than society has. You know, it's really Me Too really came into, you know, the whole discussion about Me Too, you know, started last year. Burning Man has been discussing, you know, these things for longer than that.
Yeah. And as you note in the story that you wrote, that's at NewYorkTimes.com, and for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet this out after the program so you can read the story for yourself. But as you note in the story, the founder recently died. And so what is there any discussion about how the festival might shift or start to look differently in new hands?
You know, everybody asks that question, and it's a great question, but I don't think really anybody knows the answer yet. I think you've got 70,000 people who attend yearly, and organizers would like to make it available to more people. You know, in 2011, I believe, was the first year that tickets sold out. And so there were lots of people who couldn't go. You know, and if you have a festival based on radical inclusion and people can't show up, it's kind of, you know,
kind
it's a dichotomy.
Issue. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's a dichotomy, right? Mm-hmm. So there's been some talk about maybe allowing more people, but, you know, you have to realize they hold the festival in the middle of the desert, and whatever you pack in, you have to pack out. And they're very thoughtful about not, you know, impacting the desert, not ruining the desert, basically. And so the more people you have, the more things, you know, the environment will change. And so, you know, there's probably some discussion about making it larger, whether it happens or not. You know, maybe now that, you know, Larry always really tried to keep it very intimate, you know, so that people could really experience one another and experience the art. So maybe that's one thing that could change, but I think it's too soon.
Yeah, remains to be seen. Well, Laura M. Holson, reporter at New York Times, thank you so much for joining us, and we shall see you next time.
Great. Thank you so much, Amy.
Thank you. All right, we're going to take a little break and come back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Kind of a dreary-ish day, but we're going to keep you up to date on weather, news, all that good stuff at the top and bottom of every hour as we keep checking in with Bob Kessler in the newsroom. Okay, so today on the show, we started off talking a little bit about Elon Musk, but mostly we have been talking about vices, I suppose, right? Because we talked about the brewery in Glenview. We talked about Burning Man and what it is and is not happening, what is and is not happening there at the desert. So what is left, of course, caffeine. We got to talk about caffeine.
And working our way down.
We're easing up. We're withdrawing from the things, what we're doing. So Starbucks has been quietly, apparently, testing out a little bit healthier Frappuccino recipe. This is according to CNN. So for more than a year, they have been testing a new Frappuccino and flavored latte recipes in about 600 stores in Rhode Island, Missouri, and California. That is real specific right there. Of course, not Illinois. Thanks. And so the traditional flavor, traditional recipes, rather, like flavors like vanilla and hazelnut and all that, it's added into the drinks. And it's like a, you see them do it, right? It's like this big pump thing and they pump in this clear and it's just sugary syrup with flavor made out of God knows what. So they're, this new recipe has fewer calories, a little bit less sugar, still, let's not get too excited, right? Because a 16 ounce caramel variety, is 370 calories instead of 420 and 49 grams of sugar instead of 67 grams of sugar. So still, that's a lot. That's 49 grams of sugar is still quite a bit.
What if they used to, in school, they would say a gram is like a paperclip? That's the measurement that we always got, like the weight of a paperclip?
I think that's about right.
Is that about right?
Yeah.
To think of that much sugar.
Right. That's a boatload of sugar. And, you know, in the last hour, Pete McMurray was in for John Williams and he was talking with, Don Jackson Blattner about sugar and diet and all that. And they were talking about just root beer and how like a can of root beer had like 59 grams of sugar. But that's the thing is there's so much sugar in all the things.
Well, and they were talking about the keto diet.
Yeah.
And which you sort of practice your own version of.
Yeah, I don't like to obsess about anything.
Right.
Right. So I'm, you know, 80-20 on it, and I'm just about eating healthy. And
but that's
mostly because I have too many jobs, and I just need a lot of energy to get through them all. But yes.
That's higher in fat.
Higher in fat, but it's all about low sugar. And I've kept, like, carb and sugar low for a long time. So this is interesting to me, but it's still, like...
Well, and it's worth noting, I mean,
they're trying.
They seemed very aware of it. You are, yeah. Certainly, and I think... But you guys are more health conscious than probably the average person. I mean, certainly you and Don. But it's like your job, practically.
Sure.
A lot of people didn't realize, I think, and this was a controversy a little bit, that the amount to which sugar contributes to weight gain and as opposed to fat.
Right.
For the long time, public opinion or public knowledge was sort of... I don't know,
skewed
in that way.
I remember a friend of mine with a bag of Skittles, she's going, they're fat-free. And I was like, okay, yes, but you just ate like 600 grams of sugar.
But that's understandable because, and this was the controversy surrounding it, was there was the sugar lobby was very powerful
and
for many years and did a lot to stifle research.
Totally.
And to demonize fats.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you see like... Even like milk does the body good. Like recognize there's a group of people who have a financial interest in that food.
Yeah.
Do your own research. Know what works for your body, right? But it's interesting that we're talking about this like healthier version of a Starbucks drink because if you recall, about a year ago, Griffin, we were, well, we're not sitting here. We were at the Tribune Tower. But we were talking about that, what was it called? The Unicorn Frappuccino.
I think that's what it was.
And I was so angry about it because it had something like 175 grams of sugar.
But it was rainbow colored. It was fun.
Yeah. But it's where we got on the conversation with Bob Kessler about the infantilization of food, right? Because we were talking about like the baby drinks and all that, right? And the mermaid toast. And I was like, just eat your toast. Oh my God. Yeah. But you know, I mean, if you look at the Starbucks menu and the stuff on it, I mean, there are some really major health hits that one would take. And, you know, and I think a lot of times, especially with something like Starbucks, like people will informally go like, yeah, I need a little caffeine this afternoon and we'll pop in. But it's like, you'd basically just order dessert.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And so these new recipes are part of Starbucks' effort to reduce sugars in its beverages by 25%. By 2020. That's their goal.
Which is around the same goal that we were just talking about 2 weeks ago on the show, because they're also trying to cut out, change the lids and use less plastic and the little, like, not the straw, but the, I don't know what that thing is called, where you plug the coffee lid with a tiny little thing that looks like a mini stirrer. I don't know if that thing has a name, but they're trying to use less of those and less plastic.
Right.
So, I don't know.
They're trying, I guess.
They're trying, but I just...
Or they're making a lot of noise about trying.
That's what I say. Yeah, they're either trying or they're letting us know they're trying, sort of.
Well, what's 25% of... What, 67? There's still going to be an awful lot of sugar in there.
Well, right. That's the thing. It's like, I ate a reduced calorie chocolate cake. Okay, but you still ate the whole chocolate cake. So, you know, there's that. Well, it's always interesting stuff. So, That's what's happening with Starbucks. Well, it doesn't feel like Labor Day because, well, I mean, you know, the business that we're in, where I was going to say, well, it's Labor Day. Happy Labor Day. But no, we do this.
We'll be working on Monday. Yeah. That's okay.
That's okay. Well, happy Labor Day to everyone.
Yes.
If you are laboring on Labor Day, especially happy Labor Day to you.
Yeah. That's like the truest form of celebration.
Right? I'm celebrating by working because I don't have a choice.
No, that's the opposite.
Literally the opposite of the things. That's all right.
It was interesting, though, to read this. The New York Times just did just a primer on what is Labor Day and the origins of it. I mean, we've been running spots similar on WGN. You probably heard them in the break there, which are fascinating, too.
Right. That are really about protecting workers and workers' rights. And not even that long ago in history, we had a very long work day, and it was every single day. And it was just about like, hey, you know what? I'm a human being, and I want to be able to, I don't know, go home and sleep at some point
and
have a life and be human.
And now I think this year especially, these issues are sort of peaked in the public conversation at this moment. For this day to come around now, it feels useful to bring up workplace conditions or just the wages and the length of the workday.
Yeah, well, I think we've talked about one aspect of this that I think is really interesting and in some ways parallels a lot of conversations happening at the formation of Labor Day, and that's kind of the worker in the gig economy space. You know, we've talked a lot about workers that have gone to great lengths because they're contract workers, because like Uber drivers and things like that, and even putting themselves in peril just to make ends meet. So I think that's probably going to be another big focus of labor conversations. I mean, we've talked about wage stagnation on this program, certainly, but I think the gig economy doesn't offer much in the way of protection for workers. So we'll be, I'm sure, looking at that here in the years to come.
I mean, yeah, the original Labor Days in the, September 5th, 1882.
Mm-hmm.
So that's coming after a huge period of economic innovation and industrial innovation. And I think we've seen not similar, maybe, but an analogous
absolutely
surge in innovation in a new field that we don't know how to regulate yet.
Yep.
And so it's only natural that there will be a sort of pushback in wanting to control the way it affects how people work in this environment.
Yeah. And I think something we touched on a little bit earlier in the program is going to be a really critical part of that conversation. That is the glorification of busy. Like in a time when where it's very easy to be tethered all the time, we have, just in the last, I think year and a half, France put some laws into place of when you can and cannot email employees, that like you can't email your employees at midnight and expect a response. You cannot expect them to look at their email prior to work hours, which,
right.
I'm like, okay,
God bless them.
That's a bit much, but also good on you because, I think in a culture and in a time when you are connected all the time, I think there is a sense of like, wow, so-and-so is not that responsive on email. It's like, well, you emailed at 2 a.m. and it's only 7 a.m. Maybe chill out a little bit. Let's give ourselves time to have a life and be human, just as was the conversation being had there at that point in the Industrial Revolution when Labor Day first formed. So there you have it. Celebrate Labor Day how you wish, but if you are laboring on Labor Day, a special happy Labor Day to you. So that does it for us. We're going to wrap things up, turn things over to our friend Scott Catoon on the Startup Showcase back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.